Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there, out there, out there, out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
This week, Frank Pacino joins me. It is the 60th anniversary of the Braxton County Monster, Flatwoods Monster incident that took place back in 1952. You've heard us talk about the story. I mean the complete story as told by Frank, who has done more investigation on this one incident, which actually was several incidents combined, probably more than anybody on the planet. Frank joins me from Florida. How you doing, Frank?
Good, good. Thanks for having me back on again.
Well, you're welcome. Not only is it the 60th anniversary, but you have a new book. Well, it's a revised book, I guess.
The Braxton County Monster Revised Edition, the cover-up of the Flatwoods Monster. When the first book came out in 2004, TJ, I had a lot of problems with the publisher and a lot of different editing problems and a lot of mistakes in the book, and I was unaware of the book and that particular way that it went out.
You weren't aware of what they were going to do to it, and was it just, did they just do a bad job, or what happened?
It was just bad. When I gave the final approval for the book to go out in that finished form, there was a lot of editing, and we kept correspondence and changing stuff. And when I got it to a position where I thought it was readable, you know, even though it was edited, it was still readable, and I understood the book had to be edited. And I gave the okay on it, and when the book came out, I was unaware that the publisher had went back in and absolutely just tore it to pieces.
Mm.
And it was almost unrecognizable. And I didn't realize it until I was out on book tour, TJ.
Mm.
So it was quite embarrassing to have my readers coming up to me and say, oh, I heard you with Stanton Friedman on radio doing a heck of a story talking about your in-depth research. How come you didn't put that in the book?
Mm.
And I heard that dozens of times. So basically, I backed away from the book. I stopped endorsing it, and it took me several years to get the rights to publish my story about the Braxton County Monster. I was bound to a contract. And in the end, I was able to reclaim the publishing rights through a law firm, big law firm, Bowles & Rice in Charleston, West Virginia, and I got my book back.
That's awesome.
And the old version of the book can never be republished again in any form, which I was happy about that. So the book had my name on it, Stanton Friedman's name. There was a lot of people involved in it, and we were very disappointed.
By the way, there will be an old book-burning party being held somewhere in Braxton County.
Absolutely. So what I did is I had spent so many years, I actually put this research case together against the publisher. So that tied me up for quite a few years.
Mm.
And simultaneously, what I was doing is I pushed on with my investigation. And I was going back and forth up to Braxton County. I was going through more documents. And I got new eyewitness testimonies. I found new information, articles. I got new photographs. And most importantly, I found some new intelligence documents from the United States Air Force.
So what are some of the things that we're going to find in this revised edition?
What I did is I basically tied together the story a lot tighter. What I have, and you can see this on my website, flatwoodsmonster.com, I have 102 locations over 9 eastern states, TJ, where UFOs were seen over 21 hours of sustained time period. And what I did is, if you go on flatwoodsmonster.com, you could actually see the map. You could click on it and zoom on it. That was the backbone of my story to figure out what actually happened. And what I discovered is the Flatwoods case was basically the end of what had happened at the end of that day on September 12, 52. not too many people had went outside of Braxton County and the Flatwoods area to see what was going around the country. And that's when I discovered all the other sightings. I used Project Blue Book documents. I used newspaper articles, firsthand witness testimonies, and I tied this whole thing together. Basically, I started out pinpointing these sightings on regional maps because mm-hmm. they were over 9 different states. And then what I did is I transferred all those sightings to my master map. And that's when everything was figured out at that point. But this took several years.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the greatest things about the whole case is the majority of documentation I found right in the government's Project Blue Book reports.
That certainly, they were very helpful, weren't they, Frank?
Yeah, very much so. It was a pain in the neck because what happened is when the originals were transferred years ago on the Xerox machines before they were photographed and put onto microfilm, they had started to fade. So it was a real pain in the neck, and it took several years to go back in. And being an illustrator and trained in calligraphy and all types of art forms, I had the patience and I had the skills to go back in on these documents and to re-ink back over them because they had faded. And I believe that's one of the reasons nobody ever looked into this case.
You know, it's almost like you were destined to do this in your lifetime, Frank.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, and absolutely. And the one person who had said that to me quite a few times was Kathleen May.
Mm.
And in my new introduction in my book, I talk a little bit about that. I work with the May family very close. The people involved in this story, TJ, were made fools out of
mm-hmm.
when this happened. And I vindicated these people. They weren't too helpful at the beginning, and I can't blame them because so many people had made a big farce out of it.
You were an outsider. You were an outsider.
Yeah, to boot.
And these people were probably very humble, down-to-earth people that made their living.
They're all hard-working folk.
Yep. Blue-collared people.
Right.
What's big in that area? Do they do a lot of mining in that area? Or?
Not in that particular area. Not right in that immediate Braxton County area. Back then in the 50s, most of the people lived off of their land, you know, farm area. A lot of people commuted and went to Charleston, but what was really hard for me and for the old-timers had to really bang on to this point was when I started going up there over 20 years ago, Braxton County, and especially the Flatwoods, Gassaway, and Sutton area, look nothing like it did mm-hmm. back then. You know, McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken's at every corner
right.
now. You know, and it's even in the past 20 years since that point, it's unbelievable how everything is built up. And there was no main interstate through there. And an interesting point I found out is there's documentation in the press up there that it was estimated over 10,000 people visited that little town of Flatwood in 4 to 6 weeks. And there was no interstate, TJ. It was
really?
Basically driving through the mountains. They were coming from all over the world.
And this was right after the incident took place.
Yes, sir. Yeah,
because this was a story that it not only went nationwide, but worldwide, right?
It went worldwide. And since the first book came out, and I have my website up, I have a lot of supporters who actually found articles and different pieces of information from around the United States and around the world, and they mail this stuff to me. So, subsequently, this book that I have now is the whole complete point of my investigation up until when the book was released.
Now, the foreword is written by Stanton Freeman, right?
Yes, sir.
And the picture on the outside is the picture that was described back in 52 by Mrs. May and the children.
On the cover of the book.
Yes, on the cover of the book.
Yeah, it was a metallic type figure, and it was approximately 12 foot tall, like steel or metal, if you want to say. I don't know, or nobody knows what it actually, the composite of it was, but it looked more like a robot. It was a small shuttlecraft.
Now, Frank, we've talked about this many times, and you've gone through the whole story, and there's always details I learn every time I talk to you. And we'll get to some of that maybe a little bit more, but you and I had also discussed that these kind of beings, I've never heard anybody talk about them in the modern day or even last 20 years. Did you get information of other people, not just in West Virginia, but other parts of the United States, having any kind of encounters with these type of beings?
From the descriptions that I learned from the Frametown incident, which happened the following night, that was George Anitas Natowski.
Mm-hmm.
They encountered a being that was approximately 12 foot tall.
Right.
I'm sorry, 9 foot tall. The Flatwoods was 12. And when I, being an illustrator, I was able to work close with the witnesses, especially the May family. I took the original 1950s interview with Snatowski, and then I actually contacted him and talked to him on the phone, and I was able to put together these composite drawings. What Snatowski saw on the following night in Frametown, which is about 17 miles away, he actually saw the Flatwoods Monster with the upper portion of its spacesuit removed.
Right.
It was, TJ. He said it was, quote, a good 9 feet tall.
But what I guess what I'm asking, Frank, was there, have you ever talked to somebody or found or heard stories in other states of somebody seeing the same type of being?
Not in the suit like that.
Okay.
But there's been descriptions very similar throughout UFO history, especially in the 50s going into the early 60s. I believe there was a couple sightings in Brazil of these reptilian-type creatures. Mm. But nothing with this, with the mechanical-looking suit. But the reptilians are pretty prevalent in UFO history and literature.
And they seem to have gone away.
Yes.
And you feel because we were shooting at them.
That could be one reason. We're not going to go back there. No more reconnaissance missions.
And maybe they've just found a way to be more, to avoid us. Yeah. Discreet us, because I can't imagine that, you know, if they're here to check us out, that they would totally disappear. Maybe they're just not as, maybe their technology got better.
Well, I think what happened that night, by the flight path trajectories, and you could, once again, you can look at this on my map, there was actually 4 damaged UFOs that came in that night, and they made repeated landings, and 3 of them came over the Atlantic seaboard. Mid-Atlantic part of the United States, and they split and went different directions. The first UFO went towards Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and the second UFO went towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and the third object, which was actually the Flatwoods Monster craft, that flew over Washington, D.C., and continued on a western flight path, flew over Virginia, and then it went into West Virginia. When it hit Upper Braxton County, it actually rerouted and flew south. That's when, a few minutes later, it flew over the Flatwoods School when all the kids saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all of this strategic flight paths of these UFOs. They knew where these areas were. It just wasn't a coincidence. Mm-hmm. If you look at the map, you can see it. They were blatantly flying towards these areas. The UFO that flew towards Oak Ridge, TJ, it actually flew about 100 miles through the no-fly zone.
So
it penetrated that airspace and was never intercepted. And what happened is the other one that was going towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, that came in shortly after. These things were in pieces. They were blowing up. They were on fire. And when the third craft came over Washington, D.C., and it was not intercepted over the Capitol area, the other two objects actually stopped and redirected and flew in the opposite direction and then landed.
Hmm.
And subsequently, what happened, and this was very interesting to piece all this together, and the majority of his testimony comes from Project Blue Book. When that third object flew in over the Capitol area in flames, it was called the Flame Over Washington. That's what it was described as in the New York Times on the following day, September 13th.
Now, I know that you, one of the most credible people you talked to was Ramey. What was his rank? He was a colonel?
Major General Ramey.
Ramey, what did he tell you? about the...
I didn't speak to Ramey. Major General Ramey, he was the deputy chief for the Air Force Staff of Operations back then. He's the guy that told the people at the press conference that interceptor planes have raced aloft several hundred times as a report of reported sightings of UFOs. Who I spoke to and interviewed was Colonel Dale Leavitt.
Oh, that's who it was, Leavitt, yes.
Yeah, Colonel Leavitt, I interviewed him in the early part of my investigation in the early 90s. I actually spoke to him a couple times. The first time he wouldn't let me interview him with a camera or a recorder. And finally I kept talking to him and talking to him, and he eventually ended up letting me do a videotape interview with him on a farm.
And what did he have to say?
Leavitt was contacted by the United States Air Force out of the Pentagon. He told me out of Washington, and he was told to go to two different areas to implement his troops into the area of Sugar Creek and the other one into Flatwoods. And what he did is he had about 180 troops. He pulled them all together, and he went down to the area of Sugar Creek, which is near Frametown. It's partway between Flatwoods and Frametown. And there was an alleged, what they thought was a Piper plane crash. And but the Air Force, when you step back and you look at it, they knew they were UFOs. Mm-hmm. The locals thought they were airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is Leavitt set his troops up, and because this thing was seen by the locals crashing into a hillside, he went out looking. Now, he told me he wasn't told what it was. They just thought it was some type of an aircraft. They had no idea. And they were out there to look for survivors, but he told me they never found anything. So after he set his troops up in that Sugar Creek area, he went back a little bit deeper into the central part of the state where Flatwoods is. Now, Flatwoods is the geographical center of the state, TJ. This is where the Flatwoods monster craft had touched down. And the craft was gone by the time Leavitt got there, but he was able to grab up a bunch of samples of liquid, like the black oil, and he told me he grabbed pieces of the leaves and wood and the soil, all types of samples from around there. And he had about 50 to 60 troops there. It was a covert mission. He came up on the backside of the farm. Mrs. May's home bordered the area of the first pasture of the farm, which was the main access to the farm. I found out, which was very interesting, and I didn't even know this place existed until years later, Freddie May informed me about it, because Leavitt told me they came in over the backside of the farm from another direction, and I didn't know back during the interview what the heck he was talking about, but when I played the tape back again and I for Freddie May, Freddie May said Leavitt came up on the logging road in the back, and he came away from the population, the neighborhood people, so nobody even knew he was up there.
So did you ever get anything from Leavitt admitting that he felt that it was, you know, did he ever say anything, well, you know, I think it was a UFO? And
oh, yeah, he knew what it was. He knew it wasn't a meteor. And I go into the, you know, his full interview was in this book, actually verbatim. You know, Frank Leavitt, straight all the way through. And, yeah, he knew what it was, whatever it was that had landed there, landed out in the field, and this thing came out of it.
Do you think he
was well aware of
it. Do you think he caught any heat for telling you this?
He probably did. But, I don't know. At the time it was released, I had kept it low profile until the first book was released, and then I put a little bit more into it. And something interesting about the Leavitt interview, TJ, is I did his interview back in the early, very early stages of my investigation, and when I was talking to him, there's a lot of stuff I didn't know what the heck he was talking about. And as time went on and I started unearthing the Blue Book documents, speaking to other locals, finding out more information, looking into the past investigations of other researchers and investigators from that era, the bells would go off. I'm like, that's what the hell he was talking about. I had no idea. If I had been able to interview Levitt today, I would have had a million more questions for him.
Right.
But back then, you know, I didn't know. He just kind of rambled. I asked him a lot of key pointed questions that he answered. But
doesn't it surprise you, Frank, that he actually answered your questions?
Not really.
Why is that?
Not really. Basically, and to put it in a nutshell, when I spoke to him and I showed him, and I did the same thing with Ailey Stewart Jr., I showed him all the documentation and the way the press had portrayed and made fools out of the people up there. And basically, in so many words, I said, Dale, you were the commander of the West Virginia National Guard back then, and they've been treating your people like idiots and fools up here for years. And I said, if you don't do this interview with me, the people, and I said, and they're your people. Mm. You were born here, raised here. I said, they're your people. They're going to go down as looking like fools for eternity.
Mm.
And, in so many words, there's a little bit more man-to-man and, a couple vulgar words thrown in here and there to be truthful. But he thought about it, and I says, okay, here, I'm going to show you. And I started laying out all of these newspaper articles in front of him.
Mm.
And a lot of the locals up there weren't aware of how much coverage this thing got all over the world. And basically, that's what happened.
So he really felt overwhelmed, like he almost had to do this.
Pretty much so. And at that point, I don't think he cared.
That's good.
Because I says, you're the one person who could really put a lot of attention to this because you were the military commander who was in charge of this. And I was actually shocked with some of the stuff he told me.
That's surprising.
He was contacted by the people in Washington, and it was unbelievable. My jaw hit the ground when I found all this out.
Let me ask you this, Frank. Getting back to your book, the first time it was messed up, do you think any of that was deliberate or was just done poorly?
I don't know. It looks like it was pretty much edited by a bunch of amateur junior high school people. And when
you don't think the government maybe found out about your book and wanted to maybe manipulated in some
way? I don't know, TJ, but you're not the first person that's brought that up to me, believe me. I've had hundreds of people say that to me.
Now, let me ask you this. The book, it says the book contains Harry Truman's September 12th, 1952 telephone call memorandum. What is that?
Yes, sir.
What is that about?
It's all the phone calls that went into the White House to Harry Truman. There's documentation and records of all of this, and Stanton Friedman actually obtained those for me. A few years ago, and he mailed them to me, and once again, they were kind of a disaster to read, and I had to enlarge them up and digitize them and go through the whole rigmarole, and I was able to figure out who called in to the White House at that point, and I was able to figure out of the timeline of what happened with the Flatwoods incident, all the UFOs that flew all over the Washington area, the flame over Washington, and all the sightings. And what I did is I laid them side by side. And Truman was actually ushered out of the White House when the crap hit the fan over Washington. He was ushered out, and there's the name of agents written on there, a couple different agents' name, and it says usher out.
Really?
And Truman, from about the time that everything hit over Washington through the rest of the day, he was gone.
Do you think that our current president and all of our presidents from Harry Truman on are aware of an alien presence? I mean,
probably.
It's speculation.
I would say they are, but to what extent, I don't know. I don't know how they couldn't know or could not be briefed about such an important topic.
I remember Jimmy Carter said he was going to find out about, because he saw a UFO, and he said he was going to make it known to the public, and then he never said a word again.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to wonder if he was told, look at this, this is what's been going on, you might want to be quiet about that.
Yeah, and don't go into anything further, and just keep your mouth shut.
Let me just throw down another course, and we'll get back to finding out what else you have to offer about the book. But I talked to you when we were going back and forth a little bit about an incident that took place not far from where I live up here called the Kinross incident, and you've done some research on that. And I had a fellow on my show by the name of Gord Heath. And I guess what I wanted to find out, in your opinion, was this, because that happened in 53, was it connected in any way to, you think, what we were experiencing in 1952?
Yes, as far as missing jets, missing planes, pilots, and the last book, Shoot Them Down, I went into that pretty extensively. Mm-hmm. Of all the fighter pilots, what I did is I used the New York Times as the basis for my research, and I looked from post World War II right up to the late 50s. And 51 to 56 was the title of my chapter in Shoot 'Em Down, called "The Six Deadly Years."
You felt that it was going on for at least that many years, right?
Oh, at least. And
how many pilots? You said, didn't you tell me once we lost more pilots than we did during an active war?
Than the Korean War between 51 and 56.
No kidding.
And I think the Kinross was actually, the Kinross case was a prime example of something happened like that.
Now,
just alone in June and July of 1952, this was a memorandum dated September 10th, 52, which just 2 days before the Flatwoods incident. And between June and July 52, there was 235 major accidents with 94 aircraft destroyed and 51 fatalities.
You know,
and then you have a CIA memorandum, and it was from H. Marshall Chadwell. He was the Assistant Director of Scientific Intelligence, and it was sent to Walter Beadle Smith, who was the Deputy Director of Intelligence. And here's a nice quote for you, TJ. A worldwide reporting system has been instituted, and major Air Force bases have been ordered to make interceptions of unidentified flying objects.
Mm.
So we got a lot of stuff going on in that era. I write extensively in my book about a fighter jet, an F-94 Starfire, that disappeared right at the onset of the Flatwoods case over the Gulf of Mexico, over Florida. I spent as many years investigating that case as probably as the Flatwoods case, and tied it all together. It was an absolute joke. I found more holes in that story than Swiss cheese, and the jet has never been found this day. I also talk about how on September 12, 1952, there are missing documents in aircraft accident reports. They were sent to higher classification, and they were actually the cases that were bookend the case that I investigated off the coast of Florida. There was a lot of stuff going on that night, and it, not just like I said earlier, we started off the little area of Flatwoods, that one little town of 300 people. This went on across the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And the new book, I also go into a case simultaneously when everything was hitting full steam here on the East Coast. There was a UFO sighting and jets chasing a UFO out in California. So the book has expanded. It's got bigger and bigger and bigger, and I probably will never finish this investigation.
No, you're going to do it for the...
You know, I drew the line for it right here, but I'm sure once this book comes out, there's going to be more people coming out and giving me more information. So the book may be revised forever.
right, until everybody eventually passes away.
Right, and that's what's going on now, that the people who are involved in this are just, you know, like as Stan Friedman says, we're racing the Undertaker.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, at least you were able to do that while people like Mrs. May and others were still alive. That's what's unique about your story.
Right.
What amazes me, and I've told you this before, is how something that was so obvious back in 1952 has been totally forgotten in our history. And you wonder, you know, it makes me wonder, Frank, how many other things, going back to the 1800s, 1700s, and so forth, have there been that have happened in this country? Not just paranormal or UFO, but how many other things have we been misled or forgotten or lied about? You know?
Right. Well, one of the key things is in the 50s era, in 1952, was the shoot down orders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to shoot down flying saucers. If you can't talk them down, shoot them down. And that, it wasn't documented very extensively. It was only a couple newspapers in the United States that covered that story. If you can't talk them down, shoot them down. And when that was disclosed in July, you just go a few weeks up ahead. It was about 6 weeks later. That's when you have these three damaged UFOs crashing around the United States, the Flatwoods night.
You know, if you look at our, you look back at our history, and I remember this because the old movies existed. Look at all the UFO movies that came out in the 50s. And of course, our media will tell us, well, we just had a fascination with them. And this is telling you that our media is lying, or they, the truth's being withheld from, you know, the previous generation is withholding the truth from them now. But they know. Somewhere, somebody in the media knows at all the networks what took place, and now they've made up this myth that, well, we had a fascination with UFOs. Well, it was spurred by what took place, a lot of it probably from 1952.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And they covered the story on the night of the Flatwoods incident. See, what happened, TJ, is all the UFO sightings, the 102 locations, that stuff was all through Project Blue Book. And then it hit the press. That was in the following morning, on the 13th. And I'll read you a couple headlines. This one headline, four states bombarded by meteor-like objects. Balls of fire in Pittsburgh. Fireball shower city area. This was in Ohio. It's just a score sea green light over area. The flame over Washington. Brilliant streak across the sky. Probably a meteor. You know, scores of Baltimoreans see meteor-like object in sky. Well, it was sure some ball of fire. I have a whole book filled with all those sightings for that one night. So what happened is the press did cover it extensively, and I took all the information from Blue Book, and I took all the information out of all of these articles, and that's how I was able to piece and plot all the points on my map. Those articles hit the Saturday morning and Saturday night in the press. The Flatwoods Monster article did not hit the press until Sunday. And at that point, it was just in West Virginia. Ailey Stewart, who I had interviewed, he was the Johnny on the spot. He released the story to the Charleston Gazette, and it was in one of the articles Sunday morning. It hit the nationwide presses Monday morning, and then a couple people started piecing together, well, we have a monster sighting here in Flatwoods, and we had this siege of UFO seen all over the area. And that's when some people started piecing this thing together. The Satowski incident didn't hit until a few years later. The guy actually, George Satowski, did an interview with
He kept it to himself for a while.
He kept it to himself for a while.
And do you blame the guy?
No. And actually, when I spoke to him on the phone, he didn't want to go forward with the story any further because of his position and being a professional and businessman. He says, I went through this once already. I don't want to go through this again.
Right.
And but, you know, it was just a lot of running around, traveling, driving librarians crazy.
Right.
You know, telling them to look up these articles. And then you have some of the smaller regional and little town papers throughout the country. And their papers only came out once a week. And then I had to find some of those. You know, because I knew the target of my research was basically in newspapers of September 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th. And then Mrs. May went on the national TV show with Gene Lemon and Ailey Stewart on the 19th. And that's, you know, that put an onset of a few more articles that came out after the 19th. And that was the drawing that the guy drew incorrectly, that the people saw it with the skirted monster with the arms and the claws. And that actually was the downfall of the story. But when I started researching the story a little bit deeper, TJ, one thing that I found out is that there was an article that appeared in the Charleston Gazette. It appeared on September 15th, 52, and it was called Braxton Monster Left Skid Marks Where He Landed.
Mm.
And what's interesting about this, this was on the Monday before Mrs. May went on TV, and the monster was drawn incorrectly. So you had about a five-day period in between. And the first full description of the monster in this article, which Stewart had given the Gazette the information for, it describes the monster wore a suit of green armor and looked like a mechanical man and sported a black spade-like cowl which extended a foot or more above its head. There's the original description that was in the press, TJ.
Mm-hmm.
That's showing 5 days later how that drawing was incorrect. The original proof was right there on that Monday morning paper in Charleston.
Well, you really must have... I don't know how you stuck with that for all those years, Frank. All the walls you ran into. I suppose once you started building momentum, though, then it was just hard to stop, huh?
Well, once I got the Project Blue Book documents and started pulling some of the other stuff out of archives, the people in West Virginia who were reluctant to work with me, they just thought I was another half-assed reporter who was going to write a silly Halloween story.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what it boiled down to. And being an outsider, I wasn't trusted very well, but I have relatives up there, so, you know, they kind of gave me a break.
Mm-hmm.
But when I started walking into their homes and laying out the Project Blue Book documents and going, here, I bet you never saw this, that's when they realized that I was investigating this thing and I was serious. I wasn't out to make a joke out of the whole story.
Not to make a buck, not to make a joke out of it.
And when I interviewed Ailey Stewart Jr., it's actually the only videotape recording of him ever done, as with Stewart, too. It was unbelievable. I actually stayed up at Stewart's house for a long weekend, about 3 to 4 days I was there. And we ran over this whole thing, and he was actually blown away with the research I had pulled out. He didn't know how extensively this thing was covered. And he got upset a couple times when he read articles that were, you know, full of crap, and he actually pulled the story together for me because he was co-owner of the Braxton Democrat, and he was the first person of authority to go up to the May home that night when he walked in, and they were all hysterical. What had happened is the local sheriff and the state police were running around Braxton County like chickens with their heads cut off. They were chasing these supposed plane crashes. They weren't plane crashes. They were a couple damaged UFOs who had mm-hmm. come into the area. The one that came up from the Florida direction and flew over North Carolina, flew over Virginia, and came in the back door from the south, actually flew over the Fisher Farm.
Frank, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've talked about this before. We probably have. Maybe I just don't remember. What did these UFOs, what was the shape of these UFOs?
They were different descriptions. Different ones that were seen that night. The UFOs actually were oval-shaped. The primary ones were oval. Then there were some that were round. The ones that were oval, basically, they were about, from me doing the drawings with the witnesses, 16 to 18 feet high and about 30 to 32 feet long when they were seen flying. I spoke to Jack Davis. He was one of the other people I interviewed. He was an adult witness, and he saw the actual craft coming over before it touched down. He saw it at close range. The other ones were round, TJ. They looked like big balls, approximately the same dimension. Then there were actually saucers seen that night over different parts of the United States, you know, the typical discs.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a couple craft that were your cigar-shaped type. And they were seen flying over from the Washington direction over Virginia and into the Braxton County area. And basically they were given descriptions. They looked like big jets. the fuselage of a jet with no wings.
Now, see, that's something I don't think I knew that before. If we did talk about that, I forgot, because I just assumed they were all the same type of craft.
No, they were all different.
And that's interesting to hear, because my next question is, and I know there's no way probably of proving this, but just speculation, because I'm curious about it. Obviously, they must have all been connected, but maybe they were different races.
When I was doing my research with a military guy, we sat back and we looked at my master map, and you're the first person who has ever brought that point up to me in probably 9 years.
Really?
I had somebody step back, a military guy I work with, and said, these objects are all different sizes, shapes, colors. I wonder if there were different races inside of each one of them.
Well, you hear about, you hear about certain types of craft. I remember the old egg shape, the Bell one or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't hear about those so much anymore. So you wonder if those races no longer visit us, or if their technology. I guess I'm always curious about that.
Yeah, well, what was great is when I was up in Flatwoods a few years ago, a fella came up to me and he told me that he saw one of the crafts at night. And the original investigators were pulling their hair out, TJ, Gray Barker and Ivan T. Sanderson, because what happened is there were so many different types of crafts that were flying over Braxton County and flying over the Fisher Farm. There were actually four different sightings over that one little farm top.
Hmm.
That one little farm top, the hill there, there were four different craft that actually flew over that. What it was is, this was a rescue mission. There were two crafts that were supposed to rendezvous over the Fisher Farm hilltop. And one of them was the one that came in from the south, went, and they were supposed to touch down. The other one hadn't reached the area yet, and they missed the rendezvous. That's the one that I tracked it and pinpointed it that crashed over in Sugar Creek where Levitt went with his troops.
Mm-hmm.
When the Flatwoods ship came in, it landed. The other one had left already, and the military people I work with said, "Wow, this is a very basic, simple search and rescue. Put your two damaged objects in an isolated area, and except it screwed up. The Flatwoods monster ship that flew over Washington came in too late. In the meantime, the other one had taken off. And what the original investigators, what I said a minute ago, TJ, is they were pulling their hair out, is they couldn't figure out if there was only one craft seen over Flatwoods, the one that had the monster in it. Why was there so many of them that were round-shaped?
Mm-hmm.
Why was there a cigar-shaped one? Well, what was great is I actually interviewed a man who saw the gigantic cigar-shaped object come in. It had actually come in from the Washington area, and he was about 12, 13 years old, and he was in his backyard with his dad that Friday night, and his brothers and sisters were with him, and they saw this thing a few miles away from Flatwoods coming in at treetop level and maneuvering between the trees and going over the tops of them. They almost had a heart attack when they saw this thing. This thing was later sighted over the Fisher Farm, and actually, Gray Barker had interviewed somebody who saw it over the farm. You know, you're talking like almost 60 years later, I interviewed somebody else who saw it minutes before. So what this thing is, so I pull out my Braxton County monster, my Braxton County map, pinpoint all the locations again, and figure out the flight path trajectories. That's what I worked on with different people. And we figured out this thing was an abandoned rescue mission. What happened is all the other ships left out of the area and out of the United States that night, except for one. The one that did not have an extended flight path was the one that took off, which was the Flatwoods craft. It flew over, and it was seen crashing into James Knoll, 17 miles away.
Hmm.
That's in Frametown. That's where the monster was seen the next night.
Now, you say crashing into, but they did not recover. The military, nothing was recovered. These things seemed to repair themselves. I mean, was anything recovered that you're aware of?
As far as the Flatwoods craft, I don't know what happened to it. The furthest flight path I have of this thing, it came over It came over the eastern seaboard, flew over Washington, Virginia, went to West Virginia, turned over the Burnsville area, came down, flew over Flatwoods, and hit the farm. When it took off of the farm, I traced it, and where I got the information was from some of the locals who had seen this thing. And then it was in some of the little newspapers, the weekly papers, and I was actually able to track it, and it was puddle jumping across West Virginia, and it landed in the last location was on James Knoll. I have no extended flight path for it. I don't know what happened to it.
After that.
If it was picked up by the military, I don't know. If it was picked up by one of their own, I don't know. But that was the only one without an extended flight path. That is your Snetowski.
Okay, let me ask you this question, and this is just out of left field. Because you've seen this for over 20 years, and you've talked to the witnesses, and you've really lived it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that this craft, certainly they were coming over installations that were pretty important, do you think they were on a peaceful mission, or were they attacking us?
By recreating the whole scenario and the timeline, basically what I did is I worked in reverse. I found out what time the Flatwoods incident took place, and I worked in reverse. All the flight paths of the three damaged objects all extend 90 miles off the coast, which is the mid-Atlantic coast. And then it was a shotgun pattern of them coming in, but they were all damaged. That's where I believe, through my research and working with military people, where there was a confrontation. It seems there was some type of a reconnaissance mission going on. And that's where they got popped. They all came in over the eastern seaboard damaged. And then you have one that came in from the south, and you have a jet that disappeared in the south. And this one came up damaged, too. Those, the Flatwoods and the one that came in from the south, those are the two that were supposed to rendezvous in the area. They were the ones crashing. Those were the craft that the local sheriff and the state troopers were chasing around. And what happened is when Mrs. May called the local sheriff's department, nobody was there. They called up Bailey Stewart Jr. They got hold of Stewart because Stewart had, he was actually former Air Force. And he would go on as an investigative reporter and photojournalist, and he knew all the state police, and he knew the sheriff and deputy. He would go with his camera to the different crime scenes and accident scenes and take pictures for the cops. So when nobody was available, he became the next person in line of authority to go up to the May's house. That's why he was the first person of authority, because the cops are chasing all these things, crashing all over the state. So that's how you have Stewart getting to the house.
Do you feel, though, Frank, do you feel, I mean, maybe this is something you can't answer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel, I know they were here to investigate us at the very least, but you have, you know, you've done research where, you know, people have had, well, Mrs. May and the kids, and then that other Sitkowski, is that his name?
Yes, Sitkowski.
He could have been hurt or injured, and he wasn't. And so these were not aggressive beings from what, I mean, what little interaction there that you recovered, right?
No. There was no hostile movements or maneuvers made towards the locals or civilians.
So one has to assume, and I know I'm stepping out a bit on this, but one has to assume that they probably came in peace, but maybe they were, because of some of the things we were doing, maybe they were coming to make sure we, you know, I don't know if you've, I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of different people that talk about UFOs,
mm-hmm.
but there's a fellow out of Canada who was abducted in 1987, and he's been on my show a couple of times, and he really felt, and he had like an experience with the Greys, and you know what the Greys are,
mm-hmm.
that it was an intervention. He
right.
came to the feeling that they were concerned about us destroying ourselves with our nuclear capabilities and the world's capabilities.
Right.
And I guess that's what I'm asking. In any way, do you feel that maybe this was an intervention or just an investigation?
Like a reconnaissance mission? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, not only are they trying to learn about us, but maybe it's part of, he feels that there's almost like a galactic intervention going on.
Well, something interesting that I had been talking with Stanton about, and he writes it in his foreword, was the Operation Main Brace. It was a NATO naval exercise, and it began on the 13th near Norway and Denmark, and it had its headquarters in Scotland. And this maneuver involved 80,000 men, 1,000 aircraft, and a couple hundred ships, and it lasted about 12 days. Well, there were contingents present from 9 countries, and these maneuvers were all in progress and going on. And what Stanton brought up was the point is, oh, no, if this is all going on, it looks like another war. Mm. Maybe they were down here on reconnaissance and checking out and seeing what was going on, because during Main Brace there was lots of sightings.
Mm-hmm.
So these ships were in motion. This was on the 13th that it actually began. So you have the 11th and 12th. There were sightings, a few on the 11th and 12th is when it went full steam. And that's the point that Stan brought up, is we had a lot of activity going on in the world just prior to mm-hmm. the 12th. So, you know, basically it's like, oh, no, look at the Earthlings again. What the hell are they doing down there? It was actually Main Brace, which was a staged war.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to do this exercise and see how it would go. And there was tons of sightings at Main Brace, and the day before Main Brace was your Flatwood. So, you know, the point is, there was a lot of stuff going on then.
Are you familiar with Jim Maroney? I don't know if you've heard of him.
No.
He's been on probably national programs like you have, but in 1987, he was taken, and he has very vivid memories while he was even while awake, but he also has more memories when he was put under. And those memories were that these beings were very concerned about our future and what we're doing to the planet
mm-hmm.
and how we're destroying each other. And it's almost like there was a federation of beings, several different types. And I guess I'm just putting this theory out there that perhaps this was kind of the start of it back in the 50s. And who knows, maybe it's been going on for thousands of years.
Maybe that's why there were so many different types of crafts. And mm-hmm. and to finish up your question of the types of crafts that were seen that night, over Delaware, later that night, there was a gigantic UFO sighted. And it was flying at very low level, and it was the size of a blimp, a dirigible.
Hmm.
And by looking at all the different research, and I actually was able to figure out there were 25 different crafts that night. And this was the biggest one.
No kidding.
Which led me to believe this was the mothership.
Mm.
It was gigantic. And it's unbelievable. It's all documented in the book. And what I did that's in this book is I have the locations and the times of the 102 locations over the 9 states where all these UFOs were seen. And I did a different map of the a different list of the locations where they crashed. So as you're reading through the book, you can actually flip to this reference page area, which is the whole back end of the book, and you can cross-reference. And I have everything in strict order. I give the sources where it came from in Blue Book, where it came from in what newspaper article, and the witnesses' names. There was a lot of stuff going on that night, TJ. And finally, it's all put together.
It's all together.
One book and one place, and this is basically my masterpiece book on the Flatwoods case.
Now, if somebody wants to get the book, they can just go
to flatwoodsmonster.com.
I mean, is it available on Amazon and all that?
No.
Not yet?
It's not yet. Right now, it's available through flatwoodsmonster.com or through the printers, which is lulu.com. And there's lots of places and references on this site, and a lot of cool different blogs have been going up lately, and you can see what's going on. And basically, the United States government back in 1953, it was a conversation between Donald Kehoe and Al Chop, who was a public liaison for the Air Force, said that it was probably an owl in the tree.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yes. That wasn't the skeptics who came up with all of that, and all the guys who were banging on that theory. That was actually from January 53, and they kind of jumped on board and took over that point of view. But as you read the book, you're going to see there was a lot more going on than an owl in a tree.
Did you ever have any kind of contact with Kehoe?
No.
Because he really was, he really became a believer, didn't he?
Absolutely. And he was right, because in the majority of the cases, the case that he followed the Flatwoods incident, and he spoke about the guys who were posing as reporters or magazine reporters or something or other, that who actually went up there and spoke to the witnesses. And he said that was revealed to him by sources in the Pentagon, but he wasn't able to prove it. All these years later, when I interviewed Mrs. May, and she told me that there was a couple guys that did go up there, and they posed as newspaper writers, reporters. So you have something that Kehoe said back in 1953, and all of these years later, when I interviewed Mrs. May, I never brought that up to her. She just told me these guys came up there right after the incident, and she wasn't talking to them, basically. She kind of stymied them and held them off. You know, she was sick and tired of talking to reporters. She kind of blew these guys off.
Right.
And in the long run is what happened. They came back, and Kathleen told me that they said they were men from Washington who were investigating this case. And they were the guys that took the oil that was splattered on the front of her uniform. And it was kind of funny. I was at Kathleen May's condo sitting down, and when she was telling me this in her living room, and she said one of the guys went over the hill, over by the tree where the monster was seen, and that was leaking and spewing oil out all over the place, and it had hit all the trees in the area through there. And she says the one guy came back, and she was standing in the field talking to the other guy with her son, Freddie. And when he came back, he had a nice, beautiful suit with a matching hat, and it was beige. She said he was covered from head to toe in oil. She said he looked like a striped zebra. Everything he touched and where he walked through there, he was dripping oil, and Mrs. May stood up and she held her arms out. She said, he was covered, Frank. He was covered in oil from head to toe. And she was kind of laughing about it. She says, because it was like, these are beautiful suits these guys had on. And the guy looked at the other guy, and he said, I wonder what Ed's going to think when we send this in for analysis. And she adamantly said, express the name Ed. She says, I never will forget his name was Ed. And she never knew who Ed was. Ed was the Edward Ruppel. He was the head of Project Blue Book back in the day.
No kidding.
And when she told me that, I knew right off the bat, the bell went off. And I didn't tell her at that point. I told her later on. I says, Kathleen, I think I know who Ed is.
Now, Kathleen just passed away, what was it, a couple of years ago?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
And she was, how old was she when she died?
Oh, God, she was up around 90.
Yeah, she was close to that, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Because she had to be in her 30s when this event happened.
Yeah, she was 32.
Yeah.
She was 32. And I work at the witnesses pretty close, TJ, and I was able to, being an illustrator, it was great because I was able to sit down and draw sketches with them. Did it look like this? Did it look like that? You know, and this wasn't one or two interviews I did with the witnesses. This went on for years and years and years, and Mrs. May would call me up once in a while, and she would say, Frank, I remembered something else. It just hit me. And she even remembered her telephone from 1952, her telephone number.
Wow.
And I just wrote it down because it's like, you know, every little piece of information may mean something down the line. But she would just, you know, I triggered it, some points of her memory. And she would say, yeah, we were talking about this, and I remembered that, and I was talking to Freddie, and they got, you know, yakking on it, and they would remember different things.
You know, people talk about Roswell, the media, I don't even like listening to them. The most biggest case ever was Roswell. We were never able to prove anything. I mean, we had some witnesses that came out afterwards. This case that Frank Fascino Jr., has researched that took place in 52 is by far, as far as I know, of course I don't know everything, the most researched, the most well-known, the most documented UFO case in the world, as far as I know. And those of you that have never heard of it, it's certainly worth looking into, because I'll tell you what, when I first talked to Frank, I didn't really believe him because I never heard about it. And then as he started to lay out the information, it's just incredible, the story. And you wonder, how did we miss that in our history? So get his book and check out his website. It's what's the website again, Frank?
It's flatwoodsmonster.com, and the name of the book is The Braxton County Monster, Revised Edition.
It's amazing. Frank, you have so much to say, and we only have so much time, and we'll talk some more down the road, and maybe, who knows, maybe we'll have some other things to share with people. Thank you very much for being on my show.
Thanks, CJ.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin McLeod.